This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning. I'm Malik Ali, founder of BFM 89.9. This is the Breakfast Grill, and we have with us this morning Stephen Gunn, co-founder and editor-in-chief of Malaysia Kini. I know you're familiar with the name. Indeed, Malaysia Kini has been the torchbearer of online news journalism for almost 20 years. So, Stephen, let's get straight to it. On a scale of 1 to 10, Stephen, with 10 being the absolute best, how would you rate the state of press freedom in Malaysia right now?
I would put it at a 6. The reason why I put it at a 6 is because of the fact that I think there's still a litany of laws that still around that restrict press freedom. The last time I checked, I think there are about 35 laws that directly or indirectly impinge on press freedom in Malaysia. But I think, you know, since the change of government, there has been an environment where journalists have been encouraged to actually say their piece.
Just by way of comparison, I mean, how would you rate it before May 9th last year?
I would say 2 or 3.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So I think the Reporters Without Borders does a World Press Freedom Index. And I think that we climbed up, just because of that turn of government, we climbed 22 places to now 123rd out of 180 countries.
That's right.
Which is not great either, right?
Yeah, I think going from the bottom quarter to the bottom half, I think that's you know, moving in the right direction. But I think, you know, you have to take into cognizance the fact that the laws are still not repealed. And until that is done, then perhaps we'll see a higher ranking for Malaysia.
You mentioned laws that needs to be repealed. What are the top ones that you think we need to focus on?
There are two. I think the top one would be, of course, the Printing Presses and Publication Act. They will have to look into the licensing regime. They will have to look into, you know, criminal defamation and all that.
Should there even be a licensing regime, for example, for print?
There shouldn't be. I don't think so. I think, you know, anyone who can publish should be allowed to publish. And I think it's up to the market to decide whether they, you know, will continue to exist. And the other law is the Communications and Multimedia Act. I think in particular the Section 233, which has been used against quite a number of people, including journalists.
Has it been used against you?
Yes, I think we were charged under that act about 2 or 3 years ago. That's because of the fact that we published a video that somehow the then Attorney General wasn't happy with. He brought charges against myself and Premesh Chandran, the co-founder of Malaysia.
What was the specific charge? I mean, what were the words used?
Well, basically, you know, you're not supposed to post anything seen as annoying, as a harassment that is taken as, you know, abusing your ability to, your rights to, post such comments. I think, you know, that particular section, when it was actually drafted, that was meant to actually go after the trollers, you know, the people who actually use, you know, the internet to actually harass people. But it shouldn't be applied to media organization. We are not harassing then Attorney General Muhammad Pandey Ali, and he's a public figure. I mean, he should be expecting, you know, reports that may be unfavorable to him.
Is there an objective test within that? I mean, meaning, you know, if Pandey Ali was the one that's annoyed, but a reasonable person would not be annoyed, does that still allow you to be prosecuted under Section 233?
I'm not too sure. I think with public figures, I think the law should actually take into consideration that they are public figures, and media organisations and journalists should be allowed to, you know, criticise them.
So those are the laws that we want to repeal.
Yes.
At least the top two you mentioned. To institutionalize media freedom, there are proposals out there, of which one you are sponsoring. I mean, sponsoring in the sense of, you know, sort of helping draft. Let's dive a little bit into the proposal for new legislation for the establishment of an independent media council.
That's right.
Could you explain how this would institutionalize media freedoms?
The whole idea of the Media Council proposal is to get the government out of the business of controlling the media. And, you know, at the same time, when you have the Media Council in operation, then, you know, the restrictive laws that we have will have to be done away with. It has to be in tandem. It has to be this parallel mechanism there.
So in a situation of people reporting a complaint that's happening of perhaps factual errors or unfair treatment of a particular story, what is a mechanism for a member of the public who wants to sort of address this?
Well, I guess, you know, they should go to the respective media in the first instance. And if they refuse to make corrections and they still, you know, no action has been taken or whatever it is, then they can go to the Media Council. The Media Council would have, I presume, a committee that would handle all these complaints, and they would come up with a decision. And depending what that decision is, you know, it may require the particular media organization to apologize or to pay a fine or whatever it is. And if the complainant is still not happy with, they can still go to the courts. I mean, that would be the last resort. Hopefully, you know, through this mechanism, we can cut down a lot of the lawsuits that media organizations are now confronting.
Like, for example, defamation, right?
That's right.
So would the Media Council have punitive powers? You mentioned just now they can ask a newspaper to publish an apology or ask an online portal to publish an apology. What else do you anticipate the Media Council to be able to do in terms of sanctions?
Well, that hasn't been actually decided upon. I think the idea is that it should have punitive powers.
A fine, perhaps?
For a proper Media Council to work. But as I say, this is just a proposal from the publishers as well as the editors. There are, you know, other groups. They may have their own proposal from the journalists, media organizations, the journalists associations and all that. And then from the civil society as well. So this is not the end of it. We will come up with hopefully we'll come to an agreement on what the Media Council should be.
Yeah. One thing I saw, the proposed Media Council proposes 24 exco members. Mm. Any business guy will come to you and say that's an unmanageable number. Mm. Is that why 24?
It was just a number that was picked up from thin air, I presume. I think, you know, it's not a perhaps not a definite number. I think, you know, it could be reduced, it could be increased depending on discussion that we're going to have. Yeah.
Another criticism, and this from Center of Independent Journalism, no less, is that, you know, the words that you've been using, you know, publishers, editors, it leans towards the interests of media owners and publishers as opposed to journalists. Mm. And also, you know, the half of the exco members of the Media Council, they are appointed by media owners and management, right? I mean, the lack of maybe civil society members in the CIG proposal, which is an alternative supplementary proposal, perhaps you have members of the public even that are elected into that role. What's your response to that criticism?
I think from the publisher's side, I think, you know, they somehow feel that they are the one who's most likely be funding this Media Council, and therefore, you know, they should have a certain number of seats on the council. But again, you know, the numbers can be discussed.
Yeah. You raise the point of funding, mm-hmm. And, you know, there's no taxation without representation. So you already mentioned one way of funding, which is from media owners themselves, mm-hmm. like, say, for example, 1% of Malaysia Kini revenues.
That's right.
Are you open to something like that for on Malaysia Kini's behalf?
I think that was the idea, really. I think, you know, the idea that, you know, we all come to an agreement that there shouldn't be any funding from the government. And that's important for our proposal.
Not even a single cent? I mean, you know, I mean, there are some jurisdictions we say, okay, a certain proportion comes from government.
I think, you know, personally, I'm not speaking on behalf of, you know, the Media Council, the, you know, publishers and owners. Personally, I'm open to that. I think, you know, we can work out a mechanism in terms of how the Media Council should be funded. And I think the most important thing is that the Media Council should not be seen to be under the government. It should be an independent Media Council.
I've been speaking with Stephen Gunn, co-founder and editor-in-chief of Malaysia Kini. After this, we'll take a closer look at ownership of media organisations. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, I'm Malik Ali. You're listening to Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking with Stephen Gunn, co-founder and editor-in-chief of Malaysia Kini. Stephen, I'd like to talk about the ownership of media organisations. We spoke to Dato' Ho Kee Tat of The Edge last year, and he feels strongly that there should be no restrictions on ownership of media organisations. Political party or not, doesn't matter. Do you agree?
To a certain extent, I do agree with Kee Tat. I think I'm quite agnostic when it comes to media ownership. I think what is, the main debate is whether political parties have a right to own media. And I think, definitely politicians would, some politicians would be against that. And I think, that's the main debate, really. It's not so much about, should everyone has a right to own the media. And I think, if that's the question, I think, why not, really? But I, I think even if political parties are allowed to own media, they should be transparent about it. And I think what is important is that at the end of the day, when it comes to media ownership, they should be transparent about, exactly who are the people who are actually, backing the media.
Let's put the spotlight on Malaysia Kini. You own about 20%. As a group, as a whole, you own about 29% of MalaysiaKini.com. Your co-founder, Premesh, owns about 37%. And about 29% of the show shares is owned by a New York-based media organization called Media Development Investment Fund. Who are they?
I think before I answer that question, the reason why Prem owns 37% of shares is partly because he's holding part of it. Maybe about 8 or 9% is actually on behalf of the staff.
Okay, all right.
The Media Development Investment Fund is a venture capital. Initially, they fund mostly legacy media, TV station, radio station, as well as print media. Mostly from countries that were formerly part of the Soviet Republic or Eastern Europe, so to speak. The whole idea was that given the change in the 1990s, the move away from communism and all that, there's a need for them to invest in some of the major media organization in those countries, and hopefully to bring about more democracy there.
One fact is that I think one of their first early investors was the Open Society.
That's right.
Which is actually sort of led by, or at one point in time, was funded by George Soros.
That's right.
So how does this impact the editorial or the purpose of Media Development Investment Fund?
Well, MDIF received funding capital from not just Soros, through OSI or OSF, the foundation, but also
What's OSI and OSF?
OSI is, well, initially it was called OSI, the Open Society Institutes. It's been changed to Open Society's Foundations. They do receive capital from banks, from the many other organizations as well. So I presume the proportion that OSF is actually put in is not that big, but it did create problems for us because initially I think we are now 20 years old. When we first started, it was actually used against us.
When did they come in? When did they invest?
They came in about 2003. That's
about 4 years after.
About 15 years ago, 15, 16 years ago.
4 years after you started.
That was because of the fact that we were having problems. We were dying at that time because when we first started Malaysia Kini in 1999, we had no problems actually funding it because of the fact that we're getting quite a lot of advertising money from startup, from internet startups, because that was at that time the internet boom. All sort of venture capital has been used to actually go to fund all these internet startups, and they're all advertising in Malaysia Kini then, because we're already the biggest website then, and they have no problems doing that because you know, they themselves are actually internet startups, unlike, you know, brick and mortar companies who may have problems actually resistant in actually going, you know, doing online advertising at that time. Then, of course, you know, we had the internet bust 2001, and immediately you can see that all these startups disappeared. Because, you know, suddenly, you know, there's a realization by the venture capitalists in those days that they're not going to make any money from all these startups. We lost our, you know, advertising clients. And we knew that we would be joining them. We did a pitch to MDIF. They said that, look, you know, the only way for us to actually continue on is to go for the subscription model. And there's nowhere else in the world that's actually doing that, in a sense. There were actually attempts to do that, but a lot of them decided not to continue on or decided to stop it because they're not getting traction. But we felt that, you know, that Malaysia can do it. And they felt that this is, you know, a great way for us to make sure that, you know, that we can be financially sustainable.
Fast forward, I guess, you know, almost 15 years later, in 2017, you made revenues of about 3.3 million and profits of about 200,000.
That's right.
Now that we, after May 9th and 2018, how has that impacted your revenues and your profitability?
Well, last year was an exceptional year in the sense that, you know, there was there's a lot of interest in politics. And there's a change of government and all that. And because of that, companies are warming up to Malaysia Guinea. Companies that, you know, used to shun Malaysia Guinea somehow feel that, you know, it's no longer a problem working with us. So I think we doubled our income last year. But we think that, as I say, you know, it's an exceptional year and it will go down this year, perhaps. We'll see. But we want to maintain that if we can.
Okay. Now, the fact that you are more, I guess, commercial now, I guess, you know, commercially viable and commercial, you have advertisers now, sometimes it raises difficult issues.
That's right.
You have a company out there, one of your journalists wants to write a piece which is heavily critical, but they are an advertiser. Hmm. What would be your response as editor-in-chief?
Well, we haven't changed the way we do things in Malaysia Guinea. I think when we first started Malaysia Guinea, we feel that Malaysia Guinea has to be a model, not just in terms of the fact that, you know, we report on news and views that matters, but also the fact that there has to be a complete separation between editorial and business. And that is why, you know, despite the fact that Premaj is himself a journalist, we decided that that he will focus on business side, and while I completely focus on the editorial side, on the content.
So you have the veto power over Premaj. So Premaj says, and a client mm-hmm. is upset about this, they will withdraw all advertising if you don't withdraw right. this
Premaj
article.
Premaj would not talk to me about that.
Okay.
So there's a Chinese wall in a sense between him and I when it comes to issues
wall.
Like this. Yeah, that's right.
Okay, Stephen, I'd like to talk about our role in media organizations in putting up credible stories. I know at BFM we face the same challenge too. I mean, in these days of fast news, we're always under pressure to put stories out there very, very quickly without even sometimes hearing all sides of the story. The first story goes viral and then we hear refutations, right? But the refutations do not get the same virality as the first story that we put out. Do you think we're doing justice to the public?
Yeah, it's a good question, really. I think, you know, I think as much as we can, we will try to get the other side before we go live on it. I think, you know, the problem is that, you know, with social media these days, a lot of breaking news has been just reported as is. I think, you know, people should look at the online media more like, for instance, TV station. If there's a fire, you see the reporter standing out there. reporting about, they could be 2-person killed or whatever it is, and that was, that is a developing story, so to speak. And they will say that we are not sure, this is what we know, at this point in time. And then they will continue on, and then later on they say it's been confirmed that, it's 2 persons have died. So I think that is exactly what we're doing, really. I think, you have to look at a breaking news as a developing story, in a sense that, you report what you know and whatever that you can confirm then, and then, you'll continue to update it later on. You just hope that your readers would continue to follow that story so they get a full picture of what is happening.
I mean, there's a frustration also amongst, policymakers, right? I think we had our education minister who does, an hour and a half policy speech, and then he responds to a question, an impromptu response to a question about shoes and socks. And then the only thing that's reported is about the change of shoes and socks. Mm. And that's very, I think, the story got picked up because it was great clickbait material. Mm. What's our role in that thing? Are we amplifying the wrong things?
I think our role is basically just report that, politicians say, whatever that's interesting. I think, when we reported about the black shoes and socks and all that, it's not the only thing that we report on. It's just that, the public somehow, they got attracted to that. And that became the center of the conversation. And I think that's a problem, really. And I think politicians should be aware of that. You may announce a number of things, but, you should be aware that, there are certain things that you should not be saying, or maybe say later in the different, events or whatever it is. If you want to emphasize and make sure that, the important things are being said. Because, like it or not, I think the public will decide exactly what they would listen to.
Stephen, thank you very much for coming to The Breakfast Grill. I've been speaking with Stephen Gunn, co-founder and editor-in-chief of Malaysia Kini. I'm Malik Ali for BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile. Now with wider 4G LTE reach. Barulah best.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.